Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Welcome to the JAPA podcast for the July 2020 issue. In this podcast, we summarize select articles from this month's JAPA.
I'm your co-host, Christopher Madej, Program Director at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center PA Program in Memphis, Tennessee.
And I'm your co-host, Adrienne Banning, Faculty Member, Research Coordinator, and EBM Course Director at the Drexel PA Program in Philadelphia.
So this month, we feature CME articles on Kawasaki disease, sepsis and sepsis management, articles on mental health in the COVID crisis, as well as a QRS on de Quervain's tenosynovitis. Mm-hmm.
We have a question from the editor. And this month, Harrison asks us, I've been thinking a lot lately about how PAs provide service to our profession and our communities as clinicians, as leaders, as educators, as mentors. What do you think is the single most important form of service PAs provide and why? Whew.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack. You know, my thoughts on this were, our whole purpose of being a profession revolved around being able to see patients, being able to provide care, and being able to give people in the community the access to care that they needed at a time when there were physician shortages coming. And I still kind of feel like that is where our main service lies, in that not every patient can get to a clinic. Not every patient has the means to be able to take off of work and be able to take a bus or drive to a clinic, sit for 3 hours while they're waiting to see a provider. So I kind of feel like personally, the biggest service thing that we can do as a profession is take that medical care to where the patients need it and be able to provide those services to vulnerable populations. Certainly that's what we do a lot in my program here, is preparing students to sort of have that serving mentality of saying, look, you may be working in a cardiothoracic ICU, but guess what? You're a generalist PA. That's one of the reasons why our profession exists. So you can then still be able to go and volunteer at a free clinic or volunteer to help provide services for things. And I think that's where, again, that's where I went with it. And I think that's where I think our biggest mark as a profession can be made.
In serving kind of the underserved, increasing access to care.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, right, when you talk about like why did we start, to increase access to care, but also to use the skills of people that had skills and just didn't have a way to apply them. Like, I'm here to serve. Here are my hands. I can help, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know that there's one way. Like, I feel like the question might be saying, like, is it clinical? Is it advocacy? Is it education? I think all of those ways that people are PAs, whether it's administrative, whether it's in like a trauma bay, all of those ways point into the direction of making the experience of being human better through quality medical care. And maybe you're not the person making policy. Maybe you're not the person like teaching the future. In all of those ways, though, it's a team effort forward. The single most important form of service, I think, is just keeping the why in mind. Like, why are you doing this? And is it helping one person at a time, or is it helping to do more? But I think we serve the population in whatever way, as long as we're keeping the forward momentum of improving people's lives through health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, it may not even be patient-centered. I mean, you know, Adrienne and I work in education. We have faculty meetings every single month where our clinical coordinators are pulling their hair out trying to find clinical sites this setting. So maybe it's your services to the profession. Maybe it's reaching out to your programs and saying, I would love to have a student. I want to help train the next generation. Mm-hmm. Or you reach out to your state organization and say, I would love to take pre-PAs who need to shadow. You know, everybody can contribute in their own form of fashion. And I think service is one of those words where it can mean different things to different people. And so however that falls in within your purview should be something that you should be able to contribute.
Yeah. Like, what good have I done today? Ben Franklin.
Yep.
All right, little Philly shout out. Thanks, Harrison. Getting us thinking. We have another little housekeeping snippet for you before we get into the CME. So if you are a PhD doctoral student, pay attention. If not, feel free to forward. We're going to talk about the segments in just a second. The PA Foundation for the 2020 cycle has announced their Brightman Dorn Research Fellowship. It opens on July 13th. It closes on August 14th. What this is an endowment that encourages commitment to research, so important, but specifically research on the PA profession, help us understand ourselves so we can tell our own story, advocate for ourselves. This fellowship provides financial assistance in cash. It's a $4,000 cash award. It's not a grant. There's not a requirement that the recipient use it to offset doctoral expenses. It's for doctoral candidates who are making a contribution to research on the influence of PAs on medical care. So it kind of dovetails exactly with Harrison's question to us. Are you researching the influence of PAs on medical care? Are you a doctoral candidate? Then there is potentially $4,000 of cash out for you. You don't have to be a PA. They can apply from any discipline in case you're a PA who's not listening or you know someone. And it's not a requirement that the research must focus exclusively on PAs or the PA profession. So little announcement that there's some cash out there to be had for doctoral candidates.
Free money is always good.
Yeah. I mean, you work for it. You got to apply. But
oh, yeah. No. It certainly is not implied that at all. But it's no money that is out there that's...
$4,000.
You should know about.
Go get that.
Yep.
For sure.
So, disclaimer, just remember this podcast is a summary of selected articles for this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, but they do not represent JAPA, the authors, the editors, or the publisher's opinions. And it also is not intended as medical advice.
No, but it is intended as CME. Maybe not the podcast, but maybe it makes the quizzes easier. I don't know. I try. You get CME when you read the articles. You have to read both CME articles in the month's episode. Do the post-test. Take the online test at cme.aapa.org. If you get 70% on both of them, you get one CME. So don't forget your CME because that's like 12 CME a month that you could get. A month. What am I talking about? A year. 12 CME a year. And the first CME article is Kawasaki disease. We're going to talk about the article, Kawasaki disease, shedding light on a mysterious diagnosis. It's by Jana Galupo, Alexandra Kauker, Jenna Rolfs, Joyce Nichols, and Eric Schmidt. At the time the article was written, Jana Galupo and Alexandra Kauker were students in the PA program at the University of Lynchburg. Ms. Galupo now practices at Centra Medical Group Neurology Center in Lynchburg. Ms. Kauker practices in PEDS at Johnson Health Center in Lynchburg. At the University of Lynchburg, Jenna Rolfs is program director and an assistant professor. Joyce Nichols is director of evaluation, assessment, and compliance, and a professor. And Eric Schmidt is an assistant professor. No conflicts of interest. Kawasaki disease, desquamating rash, strawberry tongue. You hear those two things, you stop reading the multiple choice question, you go look for Kawasaki disease. It was first introduced by Japanese pediatrician Tomasako Kawasaki, who identified and named the disease in the early 60s after he saw nearly 50 cases of this disease process with novel high fever, desquamating rash, conjunctivitis, lymphadenopathy. It's an acute systemic febrile vasculitis of the medium and small arteries, mostly occurring in little kids under age 5. We don't exactly know what causes it, but we know that it's maybe a hyperimmune reaction to an infectious agent. And like we've been seeing this with COVID, right? Kids getting Kawasaki-like vasculitis after exposure to a virus. Neutrophilic and lymphocytic infiltration of small vessels. It's a cascade of those inflammatory agents, tumor necrosis factor alpha, interleukins, helper T cells, cytotoxic T cells, and also the downregulation of T cells. And so all this kind of inflammation cascade targets vascular endothelium and causes some vascular necrosis. There's a seasonal pattern to it. Most patients are young. Most patients, it's often seen in children of Northeast Asian descent. Most of the kids have or have had recently a virus or history of viral exposure, and it does cluster in families. But to diagnose it, of course, that history is important. The diagnosis is clinical. You're looking for that persistent fever, rash, conjunctivitis, lymphadenopathy, oral mucosa changes. And to diagnose it, there are diagnostic criteria for complete Kawasaki disease. Intermittent fever, high fever for 5 or more days, plus at least 4 of the following: generalized maculopapular rash, bulbar conjunctival injection with limbic sparing, erythema of the lips, throat, and tongue, desquamation of the hands and feet, so peeling of the hands and feet, or cervical lymphadenopathy greater than 1.5 centimeters. So if you have any of those things, you just need 4 of them, not any of them. If you have 4 of those things, plus intermittent high fever for 5 or more days, then you've got yourself some Kawasaki disease. You can also remember it with the mnemonic crash and burn. The mnemonic is really the crash part, but the burn part is just stuck on. Crash is conjunctivitis, rash, adenopathy, strawberry tongue, hands and feet. And then the intermittent fever, high fever for 5 or more days, is the burn part. In the early stages, it's hard to diagnose because it's fever, kids are uncomfortable, generalized rash. I mean, that sounds like every virus. So it's hard to diagnose. It often gets diagnosed or misdiagnosed as a benign viral syndrome, but then the kid just doesn't get better. And then children with Kawasaki disease get worse instead of better. On exam, they're sick, they're inconsolable. In many cases, they have a conjunctivitis with that sparing of the iris, the strawberry tongue, lymphadenopathy. Desquamation comes a little bit later. Okay, so what do? Even though technically it's self-limiting, we still have to treat them to try and prevent some complications. IV immunoglobulin and high-dose aspirin, because we're trying to prevent cardiac complications like coronary artery aneurysm, peri- or myocarditis. Kawasaki disease is now the most common cause of acquired heart disease in kids. It overtook rheumatic heart disease. So you want to get this treatment started as soon as you can, definitely within 10 days of the onset of fever. Think about that IV immunoglobulin as soon as you can. It's one dose, easy peasy, 2 grams per kg. It inhibits that inflammatory cytokine cascade, upregulates production of those regulatory T cells, which we love. Know that there can be IVIG resistance in up to 10% of cases, though it isn't going to work for everyone, 1 in 10. Aspirin, we're using it for its antiplatelet and anti-inflammatory effects here. The guidelines are 80 to 100 mg per kg per day of aspirin, split over every 6 hours until they don't have a fever for 48 to 72 hours. You can reduce it to 6 to 8 mg per kg once a day until a follow-up echo is done at 6 weeks. So when you start the treatment, you want a follow-up echo after that. They should be followed by pediatric cardiology for those whole 6 weeks. And longer if they've had an aneurysm. And the length of care totally is going to depend on cardiac complications and if there were an aneurysm. If there was, how big is it? If there's no cardiac abnormalities, no coronary artery abnormalities specifically, you can stop the aspirin, discharge them from the pediatric cardiologist care too. But they might need long-term follow-up if there are complications. There is the rare but serious complication of high-dose aspirin use known as Rye syndrome. And so that's associated with chickenpox and influenza. So if you think that you've got a kid who's getting treated with high-dose aspirin for whatever reason, but in this case for Kawasaki disease, and you think they get the flu or chickenpox or varicella virus of any type, then they need to seek more medical care because you've got to figure out what to do there about their aspirin when you think they might have the flu or chickenpox because you don't want to risk Rye syndrome. We don't have to have complete Kawasaki disease. It can present atypically or incomplete. That's what we call it if that's how they present. There can be lots of complications, but in most kids, there are no complications and prognosis is excellent. So we've heard it come up in the news. It's always something you could be reminded of. Desquamating rash, strawberry tongue, Kawasaki disease.
Yeah, it's not something that you see very often, but you know, like you said, I have never seen it clinically.
Yeah, me either.
Now, having said that, I've seen lots of kids with fevers, viral syndromes in, you know,
rashes.
24 to 36 hour presentation kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it was one of those things that, you know, didn't think about, missed, maybe it didn't become, you know, clinically significant, but it's always something that you should keep on your differential with the kiddos.
Yeah. Rashes are so common, but you know, just think about it. I think that's what we do so much here. Just like, oh yeah, you need to be reminded of this.
Yep. That's it. So next article is by PA Ryan Hunton, practices emergency medicine at Frankfort Regional Medical Center, and also serves in the Kentucky Army National Guard. Thank you for your service.
Thank you,
and
Ryan.
Is a part-time instructor at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. He wrote an article entitled Seeking a Balanced Approach to Implementing Sepsis Guidelines. So to give you a quick update on the sepsis definition, this came out in 2016 with the Sepsis 3 initiative. And this is where they got away from using SIRS criteria with an infection as the requirement for making a sepsis diagnosis and came up with the SOFA score. SOFA standing for Sequential Organ Failure Assessment, which is a, it's not complicated, but it's a little labor intensive. Lots of laboratory studies can take some time to get some of those results, so it may not be something that can be quickly applied to patients. But from there, they developed what is referred to as the Quick SOFA or the Q SOFA, which is three variables that you can screen almost every patient with: a respiration rate of greater than 22 breaths per minute, altered mental status as they defined as a GCS score of less than 15, and a systolic blood pressure of less than 100 millimeters of mercury. If you have two or more of those, then that is a positive Q SOFA, and you have to think about sepsis and potentially start your sepsis protocol or at least your sepsis alert. There have been multiple validation studies that have shown mixed performance for the Q SOFA as a screening modality for identifying patients who end up later having sepsis. So keep that in mind as you're using this. Now, why are we talking about this? Well, in 2016, after this updated definition, the Surviving Sepsis campaign from the Society of Critical Care Medicine came out. And these were guidelines that essentially took into account the three major international sepsis treatment studies that were done in 2016, the PROCESS, the ARISE, and the PROMISE trial. PROCESS was done in the United States, ARISE was done in Australasia, and PROMISE was performed in the United Kingdom. And they looked at early goal-directed therapy, which was the standard of care for sepsis management, versus standard care. And what they found was strict early goal-directed therapy was not superior to standard of care. And this was debated and digested in the emergency medicine critical care world. And basically the consensus came out was early goal-directed therapy was so good and so revolutionary that it became standard of care. So even if you weren't following it to the T, everybody was still doing some form of early goal-directed therapy for sepsis management. Now, from all of this update in the definitions and the treatments, the Surviving Sepsis campaign actually came out with a one-hour bundle, which we're going to talk about some of the issues that came with this. But essentially what this was is if you had a sepsis alert, if you had a patient with suspected sepsis, you had to initiate this bundle within the first hour of patient presentation, not within the first hour of identification, within the first hour of patient presentation. And that the bundle includes measuring a serum lactate, remeasuring it again if the lactate is greater than 2, obtaining blood cultures before administering antibiotics, administering some form of broad spectrum antibiotics depending on the suspected infection, giving 30 cc's per kg of a crystalloid fluid bolus for hypotension or if their lactate is greater than 4, and administration of some form of a vasopressor to maintain a mean arterial pressure of 65 millimeters of mercury or greater in a patient who is hypotensive during or after fluid administration. Now, you might look and say, you know what, these are not bad care guidelines at all. Well, the issues with initiating these bundles was, one, CMS reimbursement for sepsis management was completely contingent on whether or not you administered this bundle within the first hour. If you missed it, or if this happened after the first hour, then your sepsis reimbursement you weren't reimbursed for it because you didn't meet those criteria. So obviously, in a busy emergency department where you have a lot of things going on, or maybe you have a patient that is not clinically evident that could have sepsis, it doesn't change the fact that they do have sepsis, and hospitals were then getting unfairly penalized for not initiating this. So what happens? You get overcalling of sepsis alerts. Somebody walks in and has a respiration rate of 23, automatically, boom, you get a sepsis alert and you start going down this pathway. That person gets a lactate, that person gets a fluid bolus, that person gets blood cultures, and it might just be that they have a respiration rate of 23 because they just walked half a mile from the parking lot and came in and they were grossly overcalling sepsis alerts, and people were then getting inappropriate therapies or inappropriate judgments. Fluids are also a drug. You might have learned in school or have been hammered into it. I certainly do this with my students. IV fluids, you treat just like any other drug that you would prescribe. It's not just a willy-nilly, give them a liter and they'll be fine. Fluids have consequences. So if somebody gets a sepsis alert and they get 30 cc's per kg of crystalloid fluids, and I always laugh about this, and I, you know, tell my students this. And for those of you that maybe have not seen me, I'm a little well fed, and so I'm tipping about 135 kilos. So if you want to give me a 30 cc per kilo bolus, you're talking about giving me 3 to 4 liters of fluid. That's a lot of fluids unless I need it. So this arbitrary just giving fluids for the sake of sepsis alerts is a problem. And the biggest thing that I have, and really the takeaway that I took from social media when all this came out several years ago, was it was forcing providers, physicians, PAs, MPs, whoever's taking care of patients with sepsis, into cookbook, cookie cutter medicine as opposed to tailoring treatments to clinical judgment. If you think they have sepsis, then you treat them as sepsis. That's fine. If you don't think they have sepsis, then you should not have to then go down a sepsis pathway just because your hospital is telling you you have to, because the reimbursement is tied to whether or not you did the bundle within the first hour or not. So, great article. It highlights, you know, the takes on how we got to this definition, what we're supposed to be doing. Probably went over a little bit into more of my take on the article and the clinical implication, just because sepsis was something that I had researched and done a few presentations at AAPA on during this time when all of these were coming out. But it's certainly worth thinking about what does your hospital system do for sepsis? How do you need to manage this? And what are some of the complications that can arise from initiating a bundle in somebody where it might not be appropriate in? So. Yeah. Kudos to Mr. Hunton for writing this article.
And a shout out, hello, to our Twitter friend. but he happened to have the CME article, mm-hmm. And that's how we pick him. I really love that you kind of talked about not using a cookbook, cookie cutter protocol, because I don't know if it is so much anymore, but if someone likes to take a shot at evidence-based medicine, oh, well, it's cookie cutter. You can't just follow what an article says. And you know what's not cookie cutter is evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. There is an article out there. It's a murky ocean, right? Like, we don't have very many things where all the evidence points in one direction and we follow it this way as it was done in a randomized control trial. What's more cookie cutter is following protocols that have been established in offices, in systems, by insurance, that this is the cookie cutter you have to follow, not EBM. When you follow the EBM, it actually says, you know, there might be conflicting evidence here, but in this case, we're talking about following the evidence for sepsis and not just doing fluids just because, but like, let's look at the difference. You
know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I always like to highlight with this is, you know, my background is in trauma, intensive care, critical care medicine, emergency mm-hmm. medicine. Sepsis was something that I felt very comfortable identifying and managing and being able to do that within the confines of my clinical practice. Mm-hmm. I completely understand that if you are a primary care provider who is moonlighting in an urgent care or an emergency room and you don't see sepsis all that often, these bundles can be life-saving because you don't know what you're supposed to do. So you know what? Just follow that because that's going to protect you, and ultimately it's going to help the patients if you don't see it all that often. The issue that I think a lot of professionals had, especially the emergency medicine folks, were we already do this. Let us do our job. Don't force us to have to do these things just for the sake of getting reimbursed for the things that we're doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's where these bundles, I think, fell short was, yes, ultimately, it's meant to help providers that don't see this all that often. And we know sepsis has a huge mortality rate that's associated with it.
Absolutely.
But if you force everybody to follow it, you're also going to cause some harm. Like you said, EBM is not 100%. If you do this, everybody's going to get better. Or if you don't do this, everybody's going to be fine.
Right.
You have to weigh the pluses and minuses. And that is where an astute provider comes in with their experience of saying, yeah, I know their respiration rate's 24 and I know their blood pressure is 105, but I know sepsis and this person doesn't have sepsis. So I'm not going to give them all these fluids. I'm not going to start them on pressors because they don't need it and I can cause them harm.
Yeah. And you're not alone. You've got a team.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't have to make this call all on your own in 1 second in a closet.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now we're going to talk about something that I'm kind of passionate about. In my academic life, lately I've been thinking about talking about researching well-being, burnout, resilience, and how do we assess and kind of combat these things. So the next article we're going to talk about is... First, something that I think needs a little bit of a warning. It talks about mental health, especially in healthcare workers. We're going to be talking about specific diagnoses like depression and symptoms of depression, PTSD. So I want to give you this warning ahead of time so that you're aware that that's the topic. I also want to say now and at the end, if you or someone else you know is thinking about hurting yourself or suicide, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. I'll say it again at the end. So the article we're going to talk about is the effect of COVID-19 pandemic on healthcare workers' mental health. It's by Heather Hall, who's a PA. She worked at urgent care facilities in the Metro Detroit area in Michigan when this article was written. No conflicts of interest. It's a great article. And in summary, Ms. Hall takes a lot of information of what we've learned from healthcare providers from previous pandemics and summarizes what we know about how it's affected their mental health to help us kind of get a sense of what we might assume is already happening, what we know is happening, but help us get a sense of what do we know about it, how it's happened before, so we can move forward in managing mental health, especially of healthcare workers in COVID and post-COVID. And this is not going to be a quick thing. This is going to be a long-term thing. So we know the stats about COVID. We hear them on the news every day. If you're watching the news, you know the stats. You know that there's little control. When you have little control on something and a will to do well, those things often collide in ways that spell out bad things for mental health. We know that COVID is killing us. We know that it's harming our mental health. And not just harming our mental health, healthcare workers included, but maybe even especially, and this article is going to break it down for us a little bit. There's a lot more in the article and a lot more evidence that's summarized and shared than we're going to have the ability to cover here. So I highly recommend if you're interested to go and read the article. The article shares that healthcare workers are already experiencing the psychological effects of the pandemic, require support, of course. We're nearly 6 months into this. Previous pandemics warned of the potential mental health care toll workers can incur. We have to commit to protecting our mental health during this and after the pandemic to minimize long-term effects. And it's going to be worse for the people who are frontline and in high stress and in dealing with this worse. We've all been affected by it in some way, but certainly some people way, way, way more than others. It has to be a commitment. It has to start now. So in mid-May, when this article was being written, getting ready for publication, in the U.S., we had 1.4 million COVID cases. Yesterday, we're recording this on July 9th, there was 3,054,000 COVID cases in the U.S., and at least 131,900 people have died, and that's according to the New York Times database. So from May to July, more than double of cases. clinicians, healthcare workers have had many clinical and non-clinical concerns, shortage of PPE, morbidity and mortality associated with COVID, fear of getting the virus, bringing the virus home, watching your colleagues get sick or die, uncertainty in every aspect of life, work environment, financial stability, job, home environment, losing a job in a time where you're a healthcare provider and healthcare providers have never been needed more than ever, being unemployed, maybe not being able to pay your bills, still carrying those student loans. We're dealing with a healthcare system that was not prepared to deal with this pandemic. And the stress is unlike stress that many have ever experienced before. And these are people who are no strangers to stress, still unbelievable level of stress. So we know that in normal times, compared with workers, normal, quote unquote, in other occupations, healthcare workers have higher levels of anxiety and poor sleep quality, but lower levels of depression. And that's just normally. And we're seeing the effects of mental health, including symptoms of depression now, anxiety, insomnia, grief, as well as PTSD. The author, you know, then goes into some of the evidence from previous outbreaks of coronavirus, specifically in the last 20 years. So SARS and the Middle Eastern respiratory disease. SARS was serious, but in comparison, the virus affected 29 countries, 8,422 patients worldwide, 916 worldwide. So I remember hearing about SARS like crazy, and it was just so small. Even though it's big, it's so small compared to COVID-19. There were psychological consequences for healthcare workers. In one study, nearly 22% of healthcare workers, we're talking about SARS now, in high-risk areas like the ED had signs of PTSD. That's 1 in 5, right? A little more than 1 in 5. 13% who were in medium-risk areas, 7% in the general population. Staff who experienced PTSD symptoms had feelings of detachment, disturbing recollections and dreams, intrusive thoughts, intrusive imagery, feelings of the trauma reoccurring. Very PTSD-like. Regarding well-being, more than half, 51.6% of high-risk area staff, almost 40%, 38.5% of medium-risk staff had CHQ-12 scores. So that's like a general assessment of well-being that was consistent with psychiatric morbidity. So consistent with damage to your psyche. Worry, lost sleep, headaches. Other studies showed similar findings. They're reviewed in the article. Large groups of people reporting stress. Lack of systemic support adds to it. When you don't have a system that recognizes it, wants to help you, wants to get better, that just makes it worse. Different professions, so like nurses, physicians, PAs, reported slightly different responses at times. We see that in burnout that we just covered in June as well. We respond to things differently. We all respond to them, but a little bit differently. Isolation from family, friends, community all contributed, along with that lack of systemic support. There are not just short-term effects, but long-term effects. In a study from Toronto, 5% of Toronto healthcare workers were examined 13 to 22 months following the last SARS patient death or discharge. Last patient death or discharge, not in the middle of it. So a year to almost 2 years later. About 5% experienced a new psychiatric diagnosis, and 19% had panic attacks. Of the people who had panic attacks, about a third, 33%, had a previous psych history, suggesting that we have to support healthcare workers with an existing history of mental health condition. But we've talked about that stigma too, is someone even able to come forward? Current COVID-19 era research from China shows that about 34.7% of healthcare workers had scores indicating symptoms of anxiety. Almost 20% had symptoms of depression. Over 20% reported poor sleep. We know how important sleep is to your mental well-being, not just to feel rested, but to regulate your emotions. Another study from China from this outbreak concluded that there's a significant number of healthcare workers who are experiencing symptoms of distress, 71.5. 50% had symptoms of depression, 44.6 symptoms of anxiety, 34% insomnia. 44.6% anxiety, 34% insomnia. I'm not sure if I flipped those things just now. Frontline workers experienced higher levels of moderate and severe symptoms, insomnia and anxiety compared with second-line workers, and the evidence just goes on and on. So I'm going to summarize what do we do about this almost verbatim because it was written so plainly so well and the message is so crucial. What does the author suggest as solutions? There's no doubt that there is a massive problem. So what are we going to do? We can't wait. We have to make the mental health of our healthcare professionals a top priority. not seeing those, you know, calls on social media as much as they were, not seeing the news of getting meals delivered, this big rally of our frontline workers that seems to be dwindling off as the news cycle changes. So we can't wait. It has to be a priority. There are self-screening tools, if you're listening, like the Beck Depression Index, IES 15, DASS, Perceived Stress Scale. They can all be used to monitor and assess levels of stress, psychological distress. Institutions and organizations have to provide multidisciplinary mental health resources for all healthcare professionals, like employee support groups, drop-in counseling, confidential employee hotlines, telemedicine psychotherapy, meds, crisis intervention. Has to be a multidisciplinary support team, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, therapists. We have to pay special attention to healthcare workers who've had close contact with COVID patients. They've had the highest risk, not of just of contracting the disease, but to their mental health. They have the highest risk of experiencing more severe psychiatric symptoms. They might need more support. We have to keep this ongoing for months and years after the pandemic at multiple levels, regional, state, national. Some healthcare systems have already begun to implement support programs to help with the mental health ramifications. For example, Mount Sinai in New York City. At Mount Sinai, psychiatrists estimated that about a quarter to 45% of frontline workers could suffer from PTSD. They are addressing it with a newly created center and 24/7 crisis line. They're also offering resilience training. Aside, I just read a Cochrane systematic review that summarized low-quality evidence that resilience training might have some benefit. So not to be totally dismissed. Columbia University Irving Medical Center, also in New York City, is beginning to offer individual and group therapy sessions. In general, it's a problem. It is going to be for a long time. It's our friends. It's us. It's our family. It's people close to us. It's the people who are going to need to take care of the healthcare system coming forward. And it has to be a proactive response, because it has the potential to improve lives of thousands of healthcare workers. Now, outside of the article, I want to point out that sometimes there are some similarities drawn between military personnel and those in healthcare faces, in that they're in systems and that sometimes they lack control. They're experiencing life and death stressors. So, you know, is there something that we can learn about mental health after military stress and how we can care for people? What have we learned? What mistakes have been made? And I just want to say that if this is you, if you even think that this is you, there is help out there for you. You, yes, I'm talking to you. Online apps, there's no shame. If you feel any of the symptoms above, or even if you don't, if you suspect them, take care of yourself like you would a patient, like you would want someone else to take care of themselves. Reach out for help. And again, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255.
Yeah, and I've been listening to a lot of other podcasts talking about this and mental health in our healthcare colleagues in the terms of crisis. And, you know, one of the things that they bring up is that in pandemics or in emerging infectious diseases, there is a lot of military terminology that is used. You know, it's the battleground, they're on the front line, you know, mm-hmm. they're mobilizing to different things. So there is a lot of that military similarities between you know, healthcare workers that are in the trenches of, you know, fighting these things. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I heard, and I really didn't think about, but it makes sense, is that, and certainly I want to preface this by saying I'm not marginalizing one group or the other, and this is not a generalized statement, but it was something that mm-hmm. I didn't think of, which is why I want to bring it up, is the military PTSD and some of the mental health that occurs in our military veterans, mm-hmm. there is a degree of training that goes into going into the military, a mindset of an individual that wants to serve and wants to get into that, which is different than a family practice PA who got into family practice because they didn't want to do emergency medicine, they didn't want to do surgery, they didn't want to do a lot of high stakes, but all of a sudden they're now getting pulled into that environment. So I say that by saying it is 100% okay if that is you or somebody that you know, to make sure that they're okay, to check in on them, because that is not what they quote-unquote signed up for.
Yeah.
But they need support nonetheless, and they mm-hmm. may feel completely out of their comfort zone, may feel completely over their head, And so it's now even more than ever our opportunities to support our colleagues that are fighting the fight, who may not be prepared as well as they thought, or what we can do to support them.
I would love to see like loan forgiveness for people in mental health and social workers who are going to work with healthcare workers. I'd love to see scholarships provided to get more people in, right? Because then who's taking care of the mental health workers? Mm-hmm. But we certainly need more, and we need more. There's lots more apps now than ever before. There's a lot more like privacy for accessing these things. But you saw it coming at the beginning when you just watch this wave kind of come through and you're like, this is gonna harm a generation.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Last thing we're going to talk about is just a quick little board review on De Quervain's tenosynovitis. This is by author Lindsay Brown Carruthers, assistant professor at the PA program at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine in Georgia, in Suwanee, Georgia. She also practices clinically as emergency medicine at Emory University. The general features of De Quervain's is pain at the base of the thumb on the dorsal side of the wrist, typically in the dominant hand, due to irritation or constriction of the abductor pollicis longus and extensor pollicis brevis tendon. Most commonly is going to affect 30 to 50-year-olds and is most commonly seen in repetitive mechanisms and overuse injuries. Clinical assessment, this is a gradual onset. This is not a acute onset. They notice it right when it happens. It's usually a gradual, slow, insidious onset, worsened by gripping or raising objects with a wrist-neutral position. Diagnosis is the classic Finkelstein's test, which is where the patient grasps their thumb in the palm of the affected hand, and then they ulnar deviate, or they flex towards the ulna to stretch those tendon sheets. Differential diagnosis that you think about in a patient who presents with this is thumb osteoarthritis. The CMC joint of the thumb is one of the more common joints that can be affected by osteoarthritis. You can also see some weird carpal tunnel variants. You can also have a scaphoid fracture in that area. So again, think about falls on an outstretched hand or direct trauma. How do we treat it? Rest, ice, thumb spica, splinting, keep it in position. Sometimes you just need a tincture of time just to allow it to calm down. You can use oral NSAIDs or corticosteroid injections into the tendon sheath directly. If they fail conservative management, or if they're having symptoms refractory to that, then we are referring to our orthopedic colleagues for potentially surgery for tendon sheath releases and other modalities. So again, quick and dirty, De Quervain's review, something that you should always think about in somebody who's coming in with wrist or thumb pain.
Happens. I mean,
it's common.
It's common. And everyone knows that Finkelstein test, but sometimes you forget what it's for.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this month.
We are on Twitter. We're all over social media. I am at PA_Made. Adrian is at The Art of EBM. Japa is at Japa Online. Special thanks to, again, Harrison Reed. You can find him at Harrison Reed PA.
Mm-hmm. Sound and sound engineering is done by Chris Made. If you haven't subscribed, please do on Stitcher or iTunes, and we'd love if you'd give us a rating too.
Give us a rating, send us some comments, let us know how we're doing, and you know, hopefully this is helping you get prepared for clinical practice, boards, or just general medical education in general.
Yeah, we're here for you. But until next time.
Until next time. Bye.